From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just about a year ago, January 2020, in China. Scientists sequenced this new coronavirus within just a matter of days, essentially creating the blueprint that would become the most rapid vaccines ever produced, with their colleagues around the world working on these problems. You might think of it as a miracle of science, a breakthrough that has already saved thousands of lives, and a lot of the work happened in this country. And so in this maelstrom of political division, with so many asking how we can unify the country, astrophysicist Adam Frank wants you to consider an idea. Maybe we already have. Writing for NBC News Online, Frank's piece is titled, "Biden Called for Unity in His Inaugural Address. American Science Provides It." He writes, quote, "Throughout all our turmoil, American science has not wavered. Instead, American science in all its forms, the institutions, individuals, and culture, has not only remained solid through the crises, but also provided us a path out of the darkness. And now it offers us a profound reminder of the greatness possible when we work together and hold fast to the truth and to our best ideals, as we must do as we enter this new political era. It is no overstatement to say that science saved our lives and our hope for the future, and it did so by overcoming all the denialists who attack its validity, dismiss its honesty and power, and repeatedly call for its funding to be cut. It is impossible to understate the magnitude of what science achieved in the face of the pandemic," end quote. But Adam Frank does not limit his scientific gaze to vaccination. This is where it gets really interesting. He writes, quote, "The vaccines were not the only example of American science bettering our lives and realizing our dreams in 2020. Artificial intelligence techniques based on Google's DeepMind, one of the most advanced computer systems in the world, pinpointed breast cancer cells with higher accuracy than doctors, promising a new generation of hyper-precise diagnostic tools for illnesses. And years after years when American astronauts were hitching rides to the International Space Station on Russian rockets because we had no next-generation spacecraft, privately owned SpaceX safely launched American astronauts into space using innovative American-designed, American-built rockets. In my own domain of astrophysics, I joined an audacious National Science Foundation project to use football field-sized lasers to recreate conditions deep inside alien worlds," end quote. I was reading this piece thinking to myself, yes, yes, right on. Wait, what? Laser beams and alien worlds. Did I miss some massive headline this year? Well, turns out, sort of. And this hour, we aim to explain a fascinating idea. As science has progressed, we've been better able to see into the stars. We now know that stars have many more planets orbiting them than initially assumed. Once in a while, we hear about Earth analogs, planets in so-called Goldilocks zones, and we wonder, is this the one? Will we soon send postcards to our alien friends, asking them politely not to vaporize our planet? Will we send them our Netflix account passwords as gestures of goodwill? Well, if that day is to ever come, some things have to happen first. We can't just point telescopes at the night sky and wait for an alien banner or a signal about a new alien sandwich shop opening. We have to have some sense of where to look so we don't waste time and resources. So what's happening with these lasers and this effort to recreate the inner workings of faraway planets? It's wild, but this could hold a big key for us. And we are ready to learn more about this with our guests here. Adam Frank, a professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester, the author of a number of books, including The Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds, and the Fate of the Earth. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
It's good to be here again.
And you know, every time we talk, I always assume it's aliens. And today we get to talk about aliens.
It's all about aliens.
Gilbert Collins. Rip Collins is a professor of mechanical engineering and physics and astronomy at the University of Rochester, associate director of the Laboratory for Laser Energetics, and director of the Center for Matter at Atomic Pressures. Rip, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Evan.
And Sarah Stewart is with us, a professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis. Professor Stewart, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Let me ask all of you just for some general thoughts on Adam's premise here. And I'll start with you. You're the author of the NBC News piece I was reading from. You really feel like we've got a unifying theme to rally around here in this moment, Adam Frank.
Well, I think American science is understanding is that, you know, people need to recognize what a remarkable thing American science is, and that it was, you know, the idea that we could have gotten a vaccine so quickly and not gotten one vaccine, but like a bunch of different vaccines. You know, usually this a vaccine takes decades to create. And you know, American science, working with scientists all around the world, we're able to make that happen. And this project which we call CMAP, the Center for Matter and Atomic Pressure, is an example of American science at its most audacious. The idea of using these fusion lasers that we have here at the University of Rochester, the laser lab, to study the interiors of distant alien worlds is remarkable. And the National Science Foundation, you know, provided the funding, said, well, when we proposed the idea, Rip was the lead on it. They were like, yeah, great idea. Let's do it.
Well, Rip Collins, do you agree with Adam's premise here that maybe we ought to take a few more moments out of our lives to appreciate and feel a little wonder about what science has been able to accomplish, especially recently?
Absolutely. I mean, this center, what we call CMAP, really, it emerged from two major movements in physics today. You know, the first one, which you've been describing, is this ability to explore matter at these atom-crushing pressures in the laboratory. And this is something we've never been able to do. We've never made material like this on Earth before. But in fact, it's quite common in planets and stars all throughout the universe. And so we use these massive lasers that are about football field long to squish matter and study these materials. And in some sense, it's the ability, the technology that has developed, both in terms of these massive lasers, but the ability to explore the matter at a billionth of a second, that is transforming how we look at stars and planets.
Amazing but stuff.
Yeah. And the other aspect is, as you mentioned, 4,000 planets being discovered recently outside of our solar system. In essence, since Galileo, humans have looked to planets and stars to really try and gain insight into Earth's place in the cosmos. In some sense, this effort, for the first time, is going to change the way we explore the universe. And also sort of how we look at materials and the possibilities for materials on Earth.
Mm. Well, as we go throughout the hour, we're going to have a chance to really explore these concepts in depth. And I know Sarah Stewart will have a lot to say about them. Generally speaking, Professor Stewart, do you feel like science is getting the love it deserves right now in this moment?
Absolutely. I think everyone we know appreciates the effort with the COVID vaccine. And in general, what it's done is to show how optimistic scientists are. And we do tackle audacious questions like, is there alien life and can we explain how it got there? And our program, focused on understanding planets, you know, is centered on this audacious idea of trying to explain why Earth is the habitable planet is and why are we here to even talk about it, right? And what we've identified is that understanding how materials behave within planets is key to understanding how they turn out. And that is one of the intersections of the center.
I find this really, really interesting. And frankly, I think it's a really interesting guide to understanding how we're going to try to explore and understand the stars. And we'll be talking about that. Now, Adam Frank, to kind of put a button on your NBC News piece, which I'll post on our various platforms, you know, there was a late comedian who once said that everything's amazing and nobody's happy. He said that, you know, he was joking that 10 seconds after we discover a new technology, we are complaining that it doesn't work optimally. And he was saying, you know, we've all been on a flight where somebody, we find out you can get internet on this flight and everybody goes, great. And then 10 minutes later, you get told, well, internet's down, and people are going, well, that's BS. And you know, and he's making the point that, like, you didn't even know this existed before. I sort of think there's an element of that with a vaccine where if you go back to late March 2020, April 2020, May, there was still a lot of talk about 12 to 18 months at best for a vaccine. Well, it turned out the first vaccines were in arms 9 months later, And yet here we are 1 month after that going, well, I can't get my mom's vaccine appointment. This is BS. You know, I'm going, wow, this really turned fast, as opposed to going, wow, this is amazing how fast. So I do think that there's always going to be an element of something that is amazing for 5 seconds turns into an entitlement 10 seconds later. Does that worry you? Because your piece is very optimistic that people have rallied around science, and Sarah's making the point that people have embraced and appreciated it. I'm a little worried that cynicism creeps in a little quickly here. Are you not, Adam?
Well, I think, you know, I think somebody needs to study that effect. The fact that, right, you know, as soon as we get space travel for 5 minutes, we're like, well, we're in space. And then 20 minutes later, we're like, you know, where's the free drink? But I do think, you know, what was really interesting about this year is how much things fell apart, right? And so what you really start to notice the importance of science, you know, when things fall apart. And as much as, yeah, right, people are already going on to, like, the problems with the distribution, which are real, right? But I really think that the especially as when the story of this is written, the recognition of how much science functioned, how much when everything else seemed to be sort of falling apart and we couldn't agree on anything and the politics was just stuck, that science really came through. American science, because of its institutions, because of things like the National Science Foundation, which has been around since, you know, the end of World War II almost. That these institutions continue to function, continue to do the very hard work of deciding which are the best projects to work on, administering them, getting the funding and the support to the researchers, maintaining the research infrastructures that needed to happen. So the Department of Energy, the National Science Foundation, all of these NASA, all of these organizations, which are, you know, I think they're cultural institutions. They're institutions of our American society. They continued to work and they continued to deliver. And the starting of this project, the starting of the CMAP project, mm-hmm. based here at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics, was a profound example of this, of these American institutions of science continuing to function and deliver in the midst of enormous stress and pressure elsewhere in the culture.
Yeah, the last point I'll make on that is I promise to listeners who are frustrated with my comments about the vaccine, I do know there's nuance here. Science produces something, and then there is leadership and administration that has to make sure that it gets out and is useful. And there is plenty of criticism to go around for how that has been handled, whether the leadership has been there, whether the planning has been there. And I do take that point. I'm sort of riffing a little bit on a wider theme about the way we encounter science and then we, you know, sort of feel entitled to it. But the frustration about some of the vaccines, a lot of it is totally legit, and I get it. And that's not necessarily a criticism of science. It's a criticism of the leadership and the planning and administration. So let's talk a little about CMAP here. And, Rip, can I just ask you, Professor Collins, you know, we explained a little bit about what it is. In the most lay way possible for our listeners, before we dive into exactly what these lasers are doing and how they will be helpful to scientists in the future, can you give me a sense for what, you know, a little bit more about what CMAP is and what it will aim to do?
Yeah. So in essence, it's a new way to explore planets and stars throughout the universe, understand what makes them tick and what the nature and possible implications of these worlds throughout the universe are, expressly by looking at the deep interior conditions. So by recreating the deep interior conditions and then studying it, even if for just a billionth of a second.
I love that. When we say CMAP, by the way, I'll say again for listeners, it's the Center for Matter at Atomic Pressures.
And thanks.
I'm going to keep emphasizing the alphabet soup for listeners. But Professor Stewart, when we think about trying to understand other planets that may be habitable, that may be homes for life, this is something that Adam and I were talking about before the program. I mean, I mentioned that I wasn't even aware that not all planets have, you know, sort of strong magnetic fields, or the conditions are very different in from different sort of groups of planets, that the average or the more sort of mean-sized planet is maybe a double Earth as opposed to an Earth. that we're not just looking for Goldilocks zone planets, or we're not just looking for Earth analogs. There's a lot more to understand about what might work here. What are the questions that you think might be answered with this kind of work here that will be really applicable in this search?
Right. So more than 4,000 confirmed exoplanets. And what we've learned is that this universe makes planets that are quite different from the ones we have in our solar system. So the most common type of exoplanet is between the size of Earth and Neptune. And so we have no benchmark, right? So we really are using our imaginations as scientists to try and explore different ideas for how these planets are made and what they would turn out to be and whether that would be habitable. So a project like understanding materials and how that determines the outcome of a planet is focused on understanding how they're built, which is much of my group's work. Planets tend to form with very exciting energetic events like giant impacts, like what created our moon. And we think that those occurred in the growth of these super-sized Earth planets as well. And that deposits the energy budget of the planet that will play out over its lifetime. And so CMAP will help us understand what energy is deposited in growing planets, what types of materials are present in their interiors, which lets us then make predictions about whether they evolve to have oceans or magnetic fields and look like a big brother to Earth or something completely different.
Are we generally hoping to find or assuming that rocky kind of planets will be the best chance for life, or is that not the right assumption?
There's certainly an avenue of research focused on finding Earth 2.0, right? We're quite keen on understanding how often something like our planet plays out. But we're also now open to the idea of quite exotic, as you say, alien worlds that do not follow our template and could turn out to be habitable. And there are probably many ocean worlds, for example, without land masses. And we would like to make the prediction on whether we expect life to arise on those as well.
In a moment, I'm going to ask Rip to tell us where the lasers come into all this. But before we get to that, Adam Frank, you have been on this program a number of times talking about, you know, just understanding the likelihood that we are alone. And let's just briefly kind of go over this one more time for listeners who might have missed that lesson in the past, which I always love. You know, so it was a number of decades ago that Frank Drake created the Drake equation. And it was rudimentary, yes, but it was based on some parameters that gave some kind of guiding idea for how many technological civilizations might also be out there. And you seem to think that we need to think about technological civilizations that existed now or ever, which is a different sort of consideration. And you refined that. And if I remember the number correctly, the possibility that we are the only one is something like 1 in 10 billion trillion?
Yeah, that was that paper that we worked on back in 2016. I think a good way to think about it.
Are you about to tell me that that's like outdated and stop going to that?
No.
Okay, good.
No. So, but I think that, you know, after thinking about this for four more years, I think the right way for people to think about it is that if we're only thinking about Earth-like planets, forget even the super Earths, right? So the amazing thing about super Earths, which are these planets that Sarah was talking about, which are between Earth and the size of Earth and the size of Neptune. Well, the most important thing about those is, A, they are, we don't have one. We don't have one of those planets in the solar system. And B, they are the most common type of planet in the universe. So not even taking those into account, if we just think about Earth, we believe that there have been 10 billion trillion Earth-like planets, or planets, let me put this way, planets in the right place for life to form, what's called the habitable zone. So there have been 10 billion trillion experiments with planets in the right place for, or planets like the size of Earth, in the right place for life to form, which means liquid water could form on them. So, you know, that is a lot of planets. That's a lot of experiments that nature has run on places where life could form. And the thing about these, and where this center comes in, is we usually think about habitability or life in terms of, like, the most basic ways, can you form, is there water on the surface?
right? So your orbit can't be too close to the star so that water would boil away on the surface, and it can't be too far away from the star so water would freeze. So that's the main way we think about it. But we realize now we have to take into account things like magnetic fields. Magnetic fields may be very important to having life form on the surface, because magnetic fields actually can shield the surface of the planet from the radiation from the star, from the most energetic radiation. We also think that plate tectonics, moving continents, may end up being very important for the evolution of life, especially if you want to get complex life. There seems to be an argument, indication that because Earth had plate tectonics, that helped life become complex. So we need to know not just are planets in the habitable zone, those 10 billion trillion experiments for life in the habitable zone, but how many of those experiments, how many of those planets actually had the other things that may be necessary for life? And those are questions that this center can ask by using the giant football field lasers.
And Professor Stewart, before I bring Rip in on the laser question then, just generally speaking, I guess I would say I'm persuaded by the math. When I look at the math alone, the possibility that we are the only ones, who can Google stuff and, order DoorDash just seems really unlikely in a universe this big and with this many chances to create a habitable planet and a technological one. So I'm persuaded to assume that we're not alone. Sometimes when I talk to scientists about this, they find that sort of tedious. They think, well, it matters not what you assume. What matters is the evidence. So, so I guess I was going to ask you if you are persuaded by the math as well and that you find this sort of an exciting pursuit given the likelihood, or do you think, well, not until we have evidence? How do you feel about it, Sarah?
So we have evidence and we have data, and it's the thousands and thousands of planets and the confirmation that around every star is a planetary system. Part of making stars also makes planets. And so the numbers are compelling. And then where you'll get the great diversity of opinion is on the question of what do you really need for the origin of life, mm-hmm. and life like ours or other forms of life. And that is the hard problem. And to appreciate, it went from a purely theoretical field, what we started calling astrobiology, to 20 years ago, to now a huge community of scientists who are doing everything from lab experiments to searching for life around other stars. And so you could think of it as a very young, very maturing scientific endeavor today, super exciting because it is much more quantitative and they've moved way beyond the Drake equation. and so I don't know the answer. I think the numbers tell you that cellular life is got bound to happen, that the chemical experiment that we did was reproduced in somebody else's petri dish. The question of advanced life and radio signals, that becomes much harder.
Sure, because then you have to figure out where the great filter is and if we somehow slipped through it or if it's actually still in front of us. If as Adam Frank wrote a number of years ago in the New York Times, that the great filter is climate change. Could be. But Sarah, just reading in the New York Times a couple weeks ago from Dennis Overby, he wrote a piece. Really, the headline writer deserves credit in this New York Times piece because it was like they wrote it for me. The headline was that a dropped call from E.T.? With the subheadline, a spooky radio signal showed up after a radio telescope was aimed at the next star over from our sun. And, of course, they're talking about Proxima Centauri. There's some mm-hmm. sort of a signal coming that could very well be sort of something that we collected some sort of data from something that's actually on Earth. I mean, these things have happened. In the past, scientists have thought they had a signal and turned out it was just when people were cooking something in the microwave in the next room over. So there's weird things that can sort of scramble the data, but they haven't yet figured this one out. And I guess what I'm wondering, Sarah, is if we find out there is technological life, is it likely to find us first, or are we likely to take the work that you're doing and that Rip's doing and that Adam's doing and say, hey, we know where to look. Now we can find it before it finds us. Does that make sense too?
So we all have the same problem. There's millions and billions of planets, and which one do we look at, mm-hmm. right? And so even for us to just understand the nearest planets in our stellar neighborhood, we have to make choices of what are we going to point the James Webb Telescope at in October after it launches, you know? And so we are really looking at the luck of the lottery on who finds whom first.
Well, so let's take our only break, and when we come back, we've already got some questions from listeners. We'll get to those eventually. Rip Collins, who is the director of CMAP, the Center for Matter at Atomic Pressures, is going to tell us how the work is being done, and now you've got a sense for how it might be applied. I mean, they are using this work to understand literally the inner workings of planets far, far away, and the more we understand about our own, the more we understand about what is out there and what might be some of the baseline needs for life, cellular life or more than that. Fascinating stuff when you think about the implications. So our guests include Rip Collins from CMAP here in Rochester, Adam Frank, professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester and the author of a stack of books, including Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds, and the Fate of the Earth, and Sarah Stewart, professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at UC Davis. And we're right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, former Rochester Mayor Bill Johnson joins us. He's had a lot to say about the inauguration of a new president. He'll talk about that and more in our first hour. In our second hour, it's our final conversation this week in our dialogue on disability. We take a look at autism, where we've come from, where we're going next. It's Friday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So, Rip Collins, how is this work being done? Tell me how the laser work. How's the laser work?
How's it work?
I don't really know how to ask this question.
That's a great question. Actually, you know, if I could just circle back.
Yeah, please do.
You know, the beautiful discoveries that are being made outside of our solar system, discovering these planets and other solar systems. There are still a ton of questions in our own solar system that are pivotal in understanding, you know, how we emerged. And some of those I think we'll be able to address in the next few years. I mean, just the difference between Earth and Venus and Mars, you know, why are the atmospheres so dramatically different? And Adam touched on that a minute ago. But also, you know, Jupiter is whether or not Jupiter has a core is one of these crucial questions in understanding how our whole solar system evolved. And that's another thing that we'll be able to touch on, both understanding the structure and the evolution of Jupiter and Saturn alike.
But Rip, let me just, that brings up a super ignorant question from me, so forgive me for this, but is there, I mean, certainly we want to understand our own planet and our own solar system. Is there an availability bias? I mean, in other words, do we assume too much that this is more standard as opposed to an outlier, whether it's Earth, our own solar system, et cetera?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, it's, you know, we know more about our neighboring planets than we do about other planets. So I think implicit bias is certainly here to stay. But we're because of all of the planets that we've discovered in the past decade, you know, our eyes are open. So hopefully we have the wherewithal to start imagining what some of these other planets can look like.
Yeah, I mean, I just ask, I'm thinking of an ant who wakes up on a croissant at a picnic, and it's an almond croissant, which is absolutely the best. That science says almond croissants are the best. And the ant is assuming that all croissants are almond croissants, because this one is, and this one's great, and this one works, and everyone loves it. But it turns out the rest are plain, or, you know, some sort of weird fruity thing that just makes no sense. And that ant, that
and
poor
you can
ant
say
is
the same thing.
Ahead, Rip.
You can say the same thing about life, and that's sort of the one of the pivotal questions is the life on Earth really the type of life we should be looking for? But I'll get back to your other question.
Yeah.
So how do we use lasers to do this? And, you know, I guess there are a few directions to go here. You know, how do we use a laser that's the size of a football field to squish matter. And without really getting into a lot of technical stuff, you know, we shine these lasers that have a power output that if you think about the Jena nuclear power plant or how much power is used in New York City, you know, we're using many times more power than that, but just for a billionth of a second. So it's not a lot of energy. But with that power, we can shine it on a sample and essentially launch very strong compression waves through the material. And these compression waves move super fast. So they move at about 100,000 miles per hour. And so within the time that it takes that fast moving wave to get across your sample, that's sort of a millimeter scale, we have to make all the measurements. And that's where a lot of the technology development has occurred in the past few years. But if I, you know, if we just, what do we mean by high pressure? Adam and Sarah both mentioned, you know, these states at the deep interiors of planets are at these extreme pressures. Pressure is a tough concept. You know, I remember when I was in high school and trying to think about what pressure meant. It wasn't as hard for me as what mass meant, but pressure was pretty hard. And so if, you know, if you look around your office or the kitchen, where everything you look at is influenced by how matter behaves at one atmosphere of pressure. So that gets back to your original question, you know, are we influenced or biased by, you know, what we see around us? And in fact, we are. All of science is somewhat influenced by that. And so our understanding of how wood behaves, how metals behave, all are really constructed by how matter behaves at an atmosphere. Wow. If we were to squish stuff to, say, 1,000 atmospheres, then all of a sudden that's enough pressure to crush metal. And in essence, you can think about pressure either as how much energy you squish into a certain volume or how much force, if you just press, you know, with your hand on a table, how much force you can apply to a certain area. You can think about it in both those ways. And in this particular case, 1,000 atmospheres, that's enough force to crush metal. At 1,000,000 atmospheres, and now we're starting to get a lot of zeros here, that's where we've packed enough energy into a small enough volume that it essentially competes with chemical bonds. And so all of the chemistry that we know and that we're so used to seeing, like water, is fundamentally different at these outrageous pressures. And I can give you one example. So all of you maybe had a glass of water this morning. If you put water under a few million atmospheres of pressure, so water, I'm just going to get sort of technical.
It's okay.
Water is, you know, hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen essentially separates from the hydrogen and it clumps into a crystal. It forms its own crystal and the hydrogen floats essentially like a fluid between the these oxygen atoms. It's just a fundamentally different behavior, which almost surely occurs, you know, in the deep interiors of some of these planets. But we've just now started to imagine and see how it behaves at these conditions. Okay, now we get to 300 million atmospheres. When we get to that kind of pressure, all of a sudden, if you took aluminum and you squished it to that kind of pressure, it's predicted that aluminum might be transparent. Okay, there's hydrogen might become superfluid and superconducting. So it's just a completely new world of behavior of materials. We can keep going, but let's stop there.
Well, let's stop there for just a moment. I mean, certainly Rip in the movies Professor Collins would turn into some supervillain. But thankfully for us, that is not going to – I mean, I don't – I think you're going to be using your laser for the powers of good here.
Your giant laser.
Your giant laser.
No, wait a second. Star Trek. If you remember Star Trek, I don't know, were you a Star Trek fan?
Man, I'm embarrassed to say.
Okay. Go ahead, use your analogy.
Well, so in Star Trek, you know, Scotty had a block of transparent aluminum, you know, on his desk. I mean, that was like the most amazing thing. I remember that as a kid. I was thinking, that can't be real. And here I am, you know, a few years later, trying to make transparent aluminum.
And you're actually doing it. So, Professor Collins, then, give me a sense for what you hope to be able to then accomplish with this. I mean, what you sort of see as the roadmap for utility and how long that can take and what kind of fruit it might bear.
Yeah, so I really see these two different avenues. I think the astrophysical implications are tremendous because for the first time we can start to try and understand planets from the inside out. And that is, for the first time, gives us a chance to understand the implications, like Sarah described, like Adam's written about. But it also gives us a chance to reimagine how materials on the surface of Earth might behave. And I think in the next decade, we're going to make just transformational discoveries on how to make and think about what types of material properties we want and then crush them to those types of materials. And I think high-temperature superconductors is one example. That's something that was just discovered that you could make superconductors at room temperature by squishing them to these millions of atmospheres of pressure. And so I think it starts to unfold a whole new generation of materials.
Wow. I've got some feedback from some listeners that we can start to work through with some general questions here. Adam, Frank, you've been quiet for a while. You want to jump in on any of this stuff here before I get to listener questions?
Well, just, this idea of pressure, I think, you know, what Rip was trying to describe is a really interesting one. And I think that, you know, if people want to get a sense of what's going on. So Rip was talking about an atmosphere, and an atmosphere is basically the weight of the entire atmosphere above us. So the unit of pressure is in atmospheres. But, you know, everybody's had the experience of diving into a pool or anybody who's ever gone, snorkeling. When you get, you know, you don't have to get very deep into water when the weight of the water above you, you can feel it. You can feel it, you know, on your ears. You can just feel the fact that there is just more pressure on you. And then, of course, you know, submarines can't really go that deep before they get crushed by pressure. So, you know, what Rip is describing is these millions of atmospheres. That's what it's like at the center of planets, especially even bigger planets, you know, they're like the super Earths. And under those conditions, yeah, material, you know, even water will act in ways that we just simply don't understand. And it's absolutely crucial for understanding if we want to know what these planets, what's possible with these planets. And so with the lasers, what's really cool about the lasers, right, is that you can take something that's the width of a dime, you know, a millimeter or so across, and you blast it with these, you know, unbelievably mega-powered lasers. And it drives a shockwave through them, and that shockwave rips through the dime or the, you know, your target, and it squeezes it for just an instant to those pressures that you get deep, deep, deep inside a super Earth. And, you know, through the miracle of science, you can actually diagnose, you can see into those compressed materials, and from that back out, you know, what are the densities? How are the electrons flowing? How easy is it to make electricity or magnetic field inside that material? How easy is it for that material to flow like magma? So it's really, you know, this project, this CMAP project that the Laboratory for Laser Energetics and the University of Rochester is leading through the funding from the National Science Foundation, really, you know, it just takes these two wild things of giant lasers, you know, and alien worlds, and shows us that actually we now have the capacity on Earth to reproduce cosmic conditions, you know, even if it's only briefly in the laboratory.
Michael writes to say, did our solar system have to evolve the way it did in order for Earth to be a planet capable of sustaining life? Adam Frank, you want to start with that?
Well, this is a good question for Sarah as well. But when you say it did have to evolve the way it did, you know, a solar system, there's a lot of accidents, right? You know, there's a lot of collisions. For example, we didn't used to think that collisions between large bodies played a role. Now we understand that we wouldn't have the moon if it wasn't for a young version of the Earth slamming into a Mars-sized body. So, you know, it's one of the things we really have to understand is how, you know, these sort of random events, like things like collisions, how much those shape solar systems and how much those, how important it is for those to turn out just the way you need them in order to have the right kind of planet and the right kind of place for life to form.
Sarah, do you want to add to that?
When we first developed our ideas for making planets, we were guided by our sample of one. Big, giant planets formed out where it's cold and there's a lot of ice, and small, rocky planets formed where it was warmer in the inner solar system. And what the exoplanetary data tells us is that a lot more different things happened, and giant planets could end up in these three-day orbits around their stars. And we've learned that many other planetary systems look quite different from ours. So we're not unique. There are other systems that do look generally like our solar system, but understanding the tipping point for what makes the Jupiters migrate all the way up to their stars or not is something we're still working out the details on.
Hmm. Well, on the subject of the work that's being done here, let me just get a couple of emails out of the way. Every time Adam's on, we get a few like this. So you have the word alien in your title of your book, Adam. Jeff says, Evan, loved the program. WXXI supporter here. Why not use extraterrestrials? Alien is passe for me. Adam Frank.
You know, sometimes also I'll think about, you know, when I think about alien, I'll think about using exo-civilizations because we now use exoplanets. So it's true there's a certain way that word doesn't carry the specific meaning, but it's fun. You know, everybody loves the word aliens. And sometimes I feel like we should move away from it. On the other hand, you know, being a Star Trek fan and a lifetime science fiction fan, I love the emotional resonance of the word alien. It's alien.
And frankly, eventually we may have a moment of real discovery. And that is, I think you really educated me a few years back that it's okay to ask when we hear about Tabby's star and Tabitha Boyjian, a postdoc at Yale, and, you know, seeing some weird signal that has all the markings of a Dyson swarm that probably isn't a Dyson swarm, but wouldn't it be cool if it were? And now listeners are Googling Dyson swarm, and you're going to think it's so cool when you find that. This whole thing on what is this signal coming from Proxima Centauri? Adam, you've at least kind of alerted me that it's okay to ask. It probably shouldn't assume it's aliens, but we can explore different possibilities without mocking it, because eventually we're getting better with technology, and not only technologies like CMAP, but also, as Professor Stewart's mentioned, where to look and what to be looking for. Is that fair, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, as Sarah said, you know, this field of astrobiology, of thinking about life in the universe, is really, over the last 20 years, has gone from being kind of like, well, we didn't even really know how to think about it, to now becoming a maturing field where we are getting very sophisticated in thinking about life in the universe. And that includes the possibility of intelligent life. So it just doesn't make any sense anymore, you know, just to dismiss these things out of hand. Of course, this is science, and, you know, extraordinary claims will require extraordinary evidence. So, you know, everything, every signal, whether it's just microbial life or intelligent life, we're going to squeeze every drop of skepticism, you know, out of it, you know, but there's no reason anymore just to like blow it off out of hand. Yes, every signal that we get, if it looks particularly weird, we have to consider the possibility that it might be a techno signature.
All right. So this is where Andrew's email comes in, and I want all three of you to address this, because I, number one, am a big fan of all of your work and what you're doing, and I do think there are interesting implications, not just because I think knowledge for the sake of knowledge is great, but also because there's practical application here. But Andrew says, I do not believe the Earth is flat. I do not believe that the Earth is the center of the universe. But today's topic drives me nuts. I think we need to take care of our planet before we explore and conquer other planets for our devices. There are so many things that need our attention here. Knowledge and people smarter than me should be applied to these issues here. Okay, Professor Stewart, I'll start with you. You know, Andrew is saying, hey, you guys are smart. Shouldn't you be working on problems right here?
This question comes up all the time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And everything we're talking about has both applied, practical, and aspirational pieces to it. And we like to focus on, you know, wouldn't it be fun to find aliens? But our day jobs right, are to understand physics, to understand the natural world, and it does speak to being stewards of our planet. And so I sit in an Earth and Planetary Science Department, and indeed, this is something we worry about all the time. And so the basic science is to understand how the world works, and that is definitely used in taking care of our home planet.
Yeah. Rip, you want to take it too? Go ahead.
Yeah. So I really appreciate that comment. I guess I'd put forth that it's really important to look outward to be able to see inward. And in some sense, for us to use the Earth as the only possible outcome of how our planet can, I'll say, evolve is, maybe missing an opportunity. I guess the other piece that I'd like to point out is, in fact, this effort really does do a lot what the listener is asking us to do, and that is looking for new ways to make materials, and the same types of capabilities are being used to try and generate new forms of energy. And so these things really are what I would call transformational and the stepping stone to a better society here on Earth. So I think we are doing it. I'm sure we could do better, but it's a start.
Okay. Adam Frank.
Yeah, just to amplify something that Rip said, I mean, these giant lasers, like what's the deal? What do these giant lasers come from? Well, they were built not to, you know, to explore alien worlds. They were built to create fusion, right? The whole point of the Laboratory of Laser Energetics was to develop, to push forward the technologies for fusion energy generation. And if we can ever get fusion energy generation, we then have an infinite supply of clean energy. So, you know, in that sense, this project comes out of what might be the most important question facing, you know, directly facing humanity, which is how do we power our society? So that's a really, so they should know, you know, so I think it's a great question. But in this case, you can really see that we, you know, what we're doing is we're piggybacking on a giant project whose sole purpose is to save humanity, you know.
And Professor Stewart, I heard you jumping in there. Anything you want to add there?
So something that the public doesn't always understand is that the National Science Foundation has as its mission, you know, curating the activities of basic science in the country and nurturing the broader impacts of that science. And so all of the decisions that are made, you talk about why is there a center in the first place, we had to compete for it. We had to argue for it and say this is the right thing to do now with our country's resources because we think it will lead to innovation, innovation in physics, innovation in technology, and innovation in understanding our place in the universe. And it's that confluence that's so exciting because it does lift everything up, right? And, that's what drives science.
Well, a different Adam says, where is this laser? Just want to know so I don't drive by and accidentally get fried. Rip, you want to hit that one? Where is this laser?
It's right next to the main river campus of the University of Rochester.
You can't steal it, can you? I mean, it's probably very hard to move.
You're not going to feel it. It's a pretty sophisticated system.
No, no, no. Not just feel it, steal it. I hope you can't steal it, Rip.
Steal it. No, you can't steal it either. Good. It's a little large.
Good. Listen, man, we're still living in the comic book world. You never know. I want to offer you all about 30 seconds for some closing thoughts on what's been a really stimulating hour. And, Rip, I'll start with you. I really appreciate what you're doing at CMAP. Some final thoughts for the listeners. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to circle back. You know, when I was a kid, I would always look to the stars and once in a while planets, and it really inspired me to try and just understand how the universe worked and get into science. And for the first time, we're now starting to explore the universe in a very different way. And I'd like to reach out to, all of the listeners, all of you, to get engaged in this. So we have quite an extensive education and outreach effort. And I think to make progress, we're going to need people who think in very different ways. And so consider this an invitation.
All right. Wonderful. Professor Stewart, keep it tight. Go ahead.
So the amazing thing is we can, in the lab, make little pieces of planets for short amounts of time, but we can basically explore everything in the universe now in nanoseconds. That's exciting.
Literally, people who are listening in their cars driving almost drove off the road. It's amazing what you're able to do. Final thoughts, Adam Frank, go ahead.
I just want actually to say for Rochesterians to recognize like this amazing thing. I mean, you know, I'm not from here originally, and I'm continually amazed at the amazing stuff in Rochester. And people should know that we have, like, literally the second largest laser in the world here that can do this amazing research. Like, we are living at a place, you're living in a town that is the absolute forefront of science and technology.
Man, great stuff as always. Adam, thanks for the conversation. I know we'll all talk soon, but Adam, professor of astrophysics at the University of Rochester, author of Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. Thank you, sir.
Pleasure.
Rip Collins is the director of CMAP, the Center for Matter at Atomic Pressures. Be careful with that thing, Rip. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks.
I am so appreciative of the hour. And Professor Sarah Stewart from UC Davis, thank you very much, Professor. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack, the producer. I'm just Evan Dawson, listening to everybody here. Let's talk tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.